let's see, a couple of things. One is, so Dr. Pham and I both were Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholars, though perhaps in slightly different generations. And oh, is that better? I usually don't have problems with people hearing me, but try and do a little better on that. The other thing is, I think the common theme across our two studies is that you get what you pay for, or you get what you, how you design things, and I think it's true in research. So Archie Cochrane, the pioneering British epidemiologist who started the Cochrane Collaborative, said that when you think about medical interventions, you should really be asking these three questions. Can it work? Does it work? And is it worth it? And you know, can it work is really answered by traditional efficacy studies that answer the question of whether an intervention works under ideal circumstances. And I would say that a lot of the research that we do today really is focused on that question. Does it work is more that traditional effectiveness question of whether it works under more ideal or routine care. And then is it worth it really talks to the issue of efficiency and a little bit of the things that Dr. Pham touched on. So, so I know I'm here to talk a little bit about medical interventions, but I want to sort of have a little fun with you guys and ask you some questions. And if you don't answer the questions or raise your hand, then Gordy's going to have to answer all the questions. So here's the question. You're the buyer for a national car rental company, and you need to decide which sedan to purchase for your fleet. So what information do you want? Just yell out some things.
Reliability.
Okay. Reliability. Okay, good.
What will your customers rent?
What your customers rent?
How much does it cost?
How much does it cost?
What are the features?
Okay, good. All these are really good things. So I guess the first question is, you know, if you're thinking about car A and you want to compare that to something, are you going to compare that to walking? Or are you going to compare that to other cars of its class? Second question I want you to think about is, do you want to know how the car performs under ideal driving conditions on a flat, sunny road? Or flat road with sunny conditions? Or are you interested in how that car performs going up a steep hill, perhaps how it handles at night, or under the kind of conditions we sometimes have here in Colorado? You might have that for you this afternoon. Do you want to know how the car performs for a race car driver who might be very experienced, or are you interested in the perspective of other drivers? And finally, are you interested in sort of technical specifications like RPMs, torque, or horsepower? Or as it's already been pointed out, are you interested in some broader outcomes like safety, fuel economy, reliability, and how long that car is going to last? So, you know,
I'm always concerned about how it looks.
How it looks. Well, I think how it looks is important too. So, you know, that really kind of brings us back to the question of pragmatic versus explanatory trial. So an explanatory trial, which is also called an efficacy trial, seeks to answer the question, can an intervention work under ideal conditions? And an explanatory, a pragmatic or practical or effectiveness trial seeks to answer the question, how does an intervention work under usual conditions? And I'm not making any judgments, I'm just bringing out the distinction at this point. Now, I was fortunate to participate in a group that was led by a gentleman named Kevin Thorpe a few years ago that developed something called the PRACI, or the Pragmatic Explanatory Continuum Indicator Summary. There'll be a test on this, so write that down. So, you know, the issue here is that most studies really don't fall clearly in the pragmatic or explanatory. I mean, they have dimensions of each of these and to some degree. And so what this tool does is it tries to sort of measure them. And so this is the tool, and we'll spend a little bit of time talking about it, but essentially what it tries to do is look at 10 different dimensions of studies, and it tries to help you both, you know, mostly for the purpose of designing the study, but also for looking at the results of the study and interpreting them with regard to where it sits on this continuum. So, oh, here we go. So we start in the center, and the center is the explanatory trial, and out on the outer poles are the pragmatic. And where a trial sits between the on a given dimension between the explanatory, and the pragmatic. And you can sort of, you can get kind of a graphical interpretation. But I think it helps in terms of designing the study, because you probably are trying, as the researcher might want to know, what is my intent here? What do I expect people to use this for? Is it designed to just answer the ideal question, or is it supposed to be more pragmatic? So one example would be eligibility criteria. So the most pragmatic would be just to include everyone for whatever that given condition that the study was supposed to. And the more that you go and say, well, we're going to exclude people of a certain age, certain comorbidities, maybe we have a compliance run-in where we exclude people who don't take medicines as they're supposed to, you end up moving more towards the explanatory. I'm not sure I'll go through all of these, but practitioner expertise, are the kind of providers who are going to deploy this intervention in the real world, or are you limiting it to people with only certain levels of experience who only work in certain centers? When you look at the flexibility of the interventions, do you basically sort of let people define what co-interventions they want to use and how they're going to deliver that intervention, or are you going to be very strict in terms of adherence of the protocol? The outcomes, are you going to limit the outcomes that that you think ideally the intervention should give and limit it in terms of duration, or are you going to look at broad outcomes over a long period of time? These are the issues. And so you can sort of graph these things. And so the most pragmatic study would graph along the outer circumference of this wheel, and the most explanatory would graph it in the middle. Now, this is not a perfect tool by any means, because it's really kind of hard to decide. I mean, they have a 4-point scale, but where actually studies fall in each of these dimensions is not a science by any means. But I think you get the general gestalt. And so I'd like to talk about a couple of examples. So a typical drug study that's designed for approval of that drug, say, by the FDA, that typically has multiple participant exclusions. It typically has a very strict protocol that, and they put in place things to make sure that providers adhere to that protocol. They monitor it, and if they deviate from it, they get feedback. It's typically delivered by highly experienced practitioners, and it's often with a placebo comparator, so kind of going back to our comparison of walking to driving. It often has limited outcomes of a short duration, which is not surprising that we often find out then after the drug's been approved that it's got these problems. Think of stent thrombosis and people with drug-eluting stents. And it often has an intention to treat design, but it often has subgroups where they say, well, let's actually exclude the people who aren't taking the who didn't take the medication, or exclude the providers who didn't follow our protocol exactly. And so that kind of study would have a Precy diagram like this. And then I'd like to compare that to a study that we've recently completed, which looked at home blood pressure monitoring. And the objective of that study was, as Gordon said, I often work with clinical pharmacists, was to see whether a clinical pharmacist-led home blood pressure monitoring study would be more effective than typical office-based care. And so the design of that study had broad inclusion criteria. So we didn't exclude people based on their comorbidities or their age. We did have some exclusion criteria based on patients taking 4 or more drugs, but that had a relatively small impact on the population. It was implemented by regular staff. We did not hire any research staff to implement this. It had a flexible protocol. We didn't monitor how people, we just told people to follow the general guidelines on hypertension care. It looked at a comparison of usual care, and it looked at clinically meaningful outcomes. And by that, what we went to the the leaders of the organization, and we said, you know, the reason why we're doing this study is we want to fundamentally change how we deliver hypertension care. The current office-based system is not really working as well as it could. What's important to you? So blood pressure control, of course, but they were interested in patient satisfaction. They were interested in short and long-term costs. So we just measured the things that they said were going to be important to them as decision makers, and we used an intention to redesign. So the Precy diagram for this is a little bit more on the pragmatic end of things. The design of the study started with people with uncontrolled hypertension, and they were randomized to usual care or the home blood pressure monitoring. The patients with usual care had an initial visit, and at that visit they were given education about their elevated blood pressure, and they were told to follow up with their doctors to address that, as well as a referral put in the system. The patients in the home blood pressure monitoring group had an initial visit. At that visit, they were given a home blood pressure monitoring. They were shown how to use it. We had a special software program that we worked with Microsoft on that would store blood pressure readings in the monitor and automatically upload those. And then basically both groups came back for a six-month follow-up visit. Within that period of time, it was a completely flexible protocol. There was no monitoring of any kind or things to enhance adherence or compliance. So essentially we asked patients to just measure their blood pressure three times a week, different days of the week or times of the day if possible. That was then transmitted to a clinical pharmacist who reviewed those and used standard hypertension guidelines to adjust the medications. And in this case, they communicated with the patients either on e-visits through the internet or phone visits. And these are the results of that study. So in the sort of reddish orange brown color is the rate of blood pressure control in the usual care group, and in the yellow color, the home blood pressure monitoring group. As you can see in the first, this is all the patients. There was a rate of blood pressure control at 6 months of 37% in the usual care group, 57% in the home blood pressure monitoring group. Interestingly, you take a look at the group of patients who are typically excluded from most studies, people, the hardest to treat patients with diabetes and chronic kidney disease, and the intervention was actually more effective in that group. We asked patients about their satisfaction with care. Overall, the patients in the home blood pressure monitoring group were 90% satisfied, and that was significantly higher than the usual care group. And then we modeled longer-term outcomes. So we asked our questions, how many patients would you have to treat for 10 years to prevent a major cardiovascular event like an MI, stroke, or heart failure? And it turned out that you had to treat 10 patients for 10 years to prevent a single major event and 50 patients to prevent a death. And with that information, we modeled the cost. We collected the intervention costs and we modeled the long-term costs. And as you can see, it's really more than cost effective because somewhere between year two and three, you actually break even. And at the end of 10 years, you're actually saving $3 for every dollar you invest. So for us, going back to Archie Cochran's questions, we think that we demonstrated not only can this work, but that it does work in routine practice because of the way we designed the study, and it is worth it. And as a result, when we went back to the leadership of the organization and presented this, it wasn't very hard to convince them to move from a research study to full implementation, and that we are moving fundamentally from an office-based practice to a home blood pressure monitoring practice for hypertension. So just coming back to the broader question of pragmatic versus explanatory trials and why the distinction matters, there's nothing wrong with explanatory trials unless you intend to use them for ways in which they're not designed. So if you do an explanatory trial and it's negative, you probably have good information that it's not going to work in routine practice. But if it's positive, you really don't know whether or not that will work in routine practice. And it's unusual for there to be an explanatory and then a pragmatic trial. Whereas if you have a pragmatic trial, the intervention is negative, it still could work under ideal circumstances. If it's positive, it's more likely to be successful. So kind of in ending, I want to come back to our original example. So on the left, we've got a physician and a patient, and they're talking. They're talking about whether or not this woman on the left should undergo a medical intervention. I'll tell you about that in a minute. On the right, we've got a car salesman and a young woman who are talking about which car to buy. It's really, in my mind, a shame that the woman who's thinking of buying the car has a lot more information about which car to buy than the woman on the left. So the woman on the left has congestive heart failure. She's 70 years old, she has COPD, she has diabetes, and she's talking with her physician about whether to have an ICD implanted. An ICD is a defibrillator that detects a lethal arrhythmia and shocks that arrhythmia and saves the person's life. Now, this woman also happens to live in rural Colorado, and she's trying to decide whether she should have this procedure. So there are explanatory trials about ICDs that show that in younger men who are healthy, who are cared for in very highly experienced centers with high volume operators, that ICDs save lives. But for this patient, there's no data on women her age, women with her comorbidities, or the kind of circumstance in which she would receive care, because she doesn't live in a community with high volume electrophysiologists. So she has much less information to make a decision than the woman buying a car. Now, wouldn't you expect it to be the other way around? So I guess I'll just end with the thought that as we want to drive our research, translate it into practice, wouldn't you rather be driving on a pragmatic than an explanatory wheel? Yeah.
So let's do a couple of sort of quick questions to David. Maybe actually, should we get both Maya and David up here? Then I would like to sort of even broaden the dialogue further. So go right ahead. I guess you could sit or stand. We could do whatever works here.
A question for both of them, actually. David, in your trial at Kaiser, that difference in the cost over 10 years clearly advantages Kaiser. But in your world and in the rest of the world, all the people that get paid in that difference over time don't want that change to happen. How does healthcare reform change that equation? How's it going to drive our policy?
So very interesting story to tell you in the answer to that. So the funder of the study was the American Heart Association, and I do a fair bit of work with the American College of Cardiology, and it turned out that there was a chapter of the American College of Cardiology in Virginia that was very interested in the work that we were doing, and they thought they would like to take that and make that a model for the state. And so they got me on a teleconference with all these American College of Cardiology folks across the state of Virginia to explain what we did, and I went through everything I just went through with you. And they asked some general questions about the technicalities of the program and so forth. And then someone said, how do you get paid? And I said, well, what do you mean, how do you get paid? And they said, well, the way our system is organized, you get paid by patients coming into the office and getting their blood pressure measured. And in your system, they don't come to the office anymore. They measure their blood pressure at home and they telemonitor it to you. So if we did what you are suggesting, then we wouldn't get paid for taking care of these patients anymore. And I said, well, that's a really interesting question. I work within an integrated healthcare system that doesn't work that way. I don't really have the answer to that. And then the questions stopped. There were no more questions. And then I got a little note, a little email saying that the chapter of the American College of Cardiology in Virginia was going to go with a different demonstration program.
I'll try not to pick on the cardiologist. I think that you can break that question down into several. So first is the question, do providers believe that a change is necessary? If they don't believe that the change is necessary, that's an entirely other conversation. If they believe the change is necessary, then I think it is the responsibility of policymakers and the providers to find paths through which, one, you make it a reasonable transition that allows them either to change their business plan and how they operate, or gives them other options. I don't mean other business plans that don't, you know, comport with the policy direction, but rather maybe they want to switch specialties. Maybe they want to change their practice setting. I mean, these changes are playing out right now. So before the Affordable Care Act, there were rule changes issued by CMS that dramatically cut payment rates for chemotherapy infusions, for cardiac imaging and diagnostic testing. And in the healthcare markets, you can see cardiologists and oncologists running for the hills. Personally, I think that's a gross overreaction. I don't mean to be glib, but if really you're talking about a salary cut from a starting point of roughly $400,000, you have some cushion there. Now, if you're talking about running a practice and you've committed to paying salaries and et cetera, you've made investments in infrastructure and equipment, then yes, it's gonna require a change to your business plan. And that's why after the chemotherapy rate changes, there were two transition years when the oncologists were basically given free money for reporting quality measures to make up for the loss in chemo infusion fees. I think that's kind of odd policy, but you know, the intent there was this transitional. The other way you move the markets is, frankly, you make it clear that the safety net will not be there forever. So when we talk about new payment models, the reason to begin the drumbeat is so that providers see the writing on the wall. If they really start to believe that fee-for-service will not be there in the not immediate but foreseeable future, they behave differently than if they think it might still be there. If they really believe that fee-for-service either will not remain or will become exceedingly uncomfortable in the foreseeable future, they suddenly become much more open to alternative ways of operating. And then you can start the constructive conversations about how do you do that? How can we help? What kinds of technical assistance? What kind of, you know, startup support? I guess that's generally how I approach it.
John?
Just kind of quasi-comment and then a question at the end. I was a medical director for a 501c3 charitable HMO a number of years ago that handled both Medicaid, at that time we did not do Medicare, as well as private sector. And I sat in a meeting with the heads of my HMO, which included nuns and other characters, this is a Catholic health system, and we were able to demonstrate with our data that we had among the best cardiac services in the state of Ohio. We were right there with Cleveland Clinic. And I said, you know, well, let's let people know about this. Oh, no. So just my question, do you know why they said, oh, no?
No, I'm curious.
Okay. I know why.
Why?
We'll attract sick people.
You've got to
drive us out of business.
We want to be B, not A, on anything. if you were in mega HMO, which one is A on the things that don't cost you much, and a B on everything else. You want to be C, you want to be D, but you don't want to be A. Because when you're A, you're going to pull sick people in. And so the real question for me on a lot of these things, as we move toward capitated or, you know, global systems, how do we reward people for taking on really tough cases? Those are hard things to do.
You pay
and there's
more.
Not good technology for it.
It's not great technology, but there are tools, there are risk adjustment tools, and you pay them more. And the reason we know that this, that you can do it, I don't mean that it's that we know that it's technologically perfect, but for example, in a physician group practice demonstration where large medical groups and health systems were offered shared savings with Medicare to hit certain spending targets and quality metrics. Though in year two, they began to risk adjust the payments, and lo and behold, the risk scores for all those patients started to go up much more rapidly than in the comparison markets where, you know, their benchmarks were being set. You know what? I actually think that's okay. And again, I need to say that these are my own personal views. But if I were to embark on a broad program like this, I would first hold a national workshop for all provider organizations and teach them how to upcode right up to the maximum of the letter of the law. Let's get to that baseline.
You
Let's
know.
Be upfront about it, get it out of the way. Then show me your quality performance. That's
let me let me throw another angle out just as a follow-up on this. This man now knows exactly the patients that you need to get rid of. And they're the people who did not do well with that home blood pressure monitoring, because he knows that the ones that did do well saved him a ton of money. And if he excluded the ones that didn't do well with it, he would have saved an even bigger ton of money. So one of the dangers here, I think, is trying to confine the board to a small group of providers. And I would argue that what we really need are accountable regions, not accountable care organizations, not accountable hospitals, not accountable individual physicians, but accountable regions so that collaboration, cooperation expands rather than contracts.
I think that that is the ultimate vision. I think that, again, this is solving the unsolvable problem in the optimization exercise and working within practical constraints. And the sort of operational issues aside, you kind of have to meet the marketplace where it is right now. And right now, there are not that many regions that are going to be able to walk that walk. And so that's why we start with accountable care organizations with the long-term intent of building toward exactly what you're describing.
I would set expectations.
All right, John.
And
do you have a quick
response,
Dave? No, that's okay.
I see Arlene has a hand up.
Arlene Ash, University of Massachusetts Medical School, Worcester. My claim to fame is that my group built the risk adjustment models that CMS uses to reimburse HMOs or Medicare Advantage plans that take sicker people than they take healthy people. And I've just been reading the research about the upcoding. And I do think that that's a manageable problem. And when the state of Washington started looking at this years ago, they took people out and they taught them how to upcode. That's exactly what they did.
It does plateau. It does.
And we will have gamers. What we need is a system which is fundamentally in its basic push, its basic incentives, it encourages and supports people who want to do a great job of giving good care. This is not what we currently have. This is what we will have if we make these changes. And they won't be perfect, and there will be bad actors who will figure out how to game things. But we want to allow people who are good actors and are smart and want to innovate. We want to give them a viable business model, which we haven't given them. So I'm right now in the UMass Medical Center, and UMass has learned how to be a great high-cost provider. They are really smart at this. They have really figured out how to game the fact that they are fundamentally a monopoly provider in central Massachusetts. And I will tell you that they are itching to figure out how to become a great value-based provider. But they are terrified about that bridge, whether they will survive financially when the things that you did last year, the report cards that you generated gave you an A because you generated all that extra volume, when they give you an F this year, and will they make it financially?
You can signal back to them, and I'm on pretty firm ground here. I think this might even reflect CMS programs. Just that the intent is certainly not to push them off the cliff. The intent is to give them every opportunity to be successful. And for a change, we have the money that lets us do that.
I'm going to actually ask a question mainly to David, but bring in a few things really that touch on my work. So this pragmatic versus explanatory conflict, of course, most of the trials and certainly therapeutics are funded by people who are not interested in knowing the best answer, but really showing their product works, whether it's a defibrillator or a new drug. And so you design the trial in such a way that it doesn't have all this messy stuff about, people who are going to be sicker or not take the medicine or compare it to something that's more practical. But actually, because when you start doing these comparative trials and real-world trials, they don't look as good. And so that's one thing. And then the other thing really has to do with something that Ed Wagner taught us. We were in some of these collaboratives with Don Berwick. And And what he was part of trials, and this is sort of implicit, but I'd like you to sort of make it more explicit and dilate on this. You know, you would look at your trial and you say, it's the gizmo, it's this gadget, you know, this electronic blood pressure with the Bill Gates software that you mentioned. And so that's what you just proved, is that that's what we need to do, is buy more gadgets. You prove that the technology works. And sort of in the same way that Peter Provost said, it's not the checklist, but it's the system around this. And again, Ed Wagner said, the reason these drug trials work were because we put all these teams in place and all these information resources, right? So it's not just this fancy, cool blood pressure cuff, right? So you want to sort of talk about that more. You created a system of care around that, and I think just to think about that more broadly or talk about that, hear your thoughts.
Well, I'll answer the first question, and I think the issue is, you create the system and you get what you want. So we created a system that drives us to these explanatory trials. But in Europe, they're far ahead of us. In several regards. So if you do an explanatory trial, so you have a new drug, and you exclude people who are older, you exclude people with comorbidities. They'll say, fine, we approve your drug for the population in which you have. We're not going to pay for it in people over 60. We're not going to pay for it in people with all these comorbidities. And so the drug companies, at least for the trials they do for approval in Europe, aren't just doing those sort of simple. I mean, there's still explanatory aspects of the trial. They still try and design it as best they can to showcase their drug, but they don't have those kind of exclusions because they know that they'll have a very narrow approval. The other thing is that in Europe, they require you to do cost. So I know that that's like a completely dirty word here in the United States, but there they actually require you to show that that it has a favorable cost-effectiveness ratio in terms of dollars per additional quality of life. And if it doesn't, then they say, well, we're not going to fund that. So that's how they handle it in Europe, and we're just behind the times. And politically, I think that our medical interests are too powerful that I don't see us changing anytime soon. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, this is kind of related to that, which is the self-management piece of that blood pressure study.
The what, I'm sorry?
Self-management.
The blood pressure management piece of that blood pressure study, was that a self-management exercise for the patient? Did they have the ability to dial up or dial down, depending upon what their blood sugar, their blood pressure was, or were they in touch with the provider and getting that advice? And this sort of using the chronic care model and the self-management planning piece or the self-management piece, how did this demonstration utilize those principles, if that's what it was trying to do?
Well, we basically were fairly flexible in the way that this was implemented. So it was implemented at 10 different clinics in our system, and we basically gave them the general principles of, you're trying to get to this blood pressure, and here are the general guidelines. So while it wasn't explicitly part of our trial to have patients adjust to their medications themselves, to the extent that the pharmacists were talking to them and saying, if your blood pressure is still a little high, you can increase this by 25 milligrams. That may have occurred. I think that, I'm not sure if I'm getting at the question that Gordy asked, but we've done a series of these trials. This is the second one we did, but we started with a series of focus groups. We did 10 focus groups with our patients. And we sort of said to our patients, look, these were all patients diagnosed with hypertension whose blood pressure was out of control. And we kind of said to them something like this, we really understand hypertension. Of all the medical conditions around, we understand the pathophysiology of it. We have really good medications, and they're really cheap. They're all generic. They, for our patients, $10 for 2 months supply. So we sort of said, well, we don't understand. Why is your blood pressure out of control? Remember, for every 100 patients with hypertension in this country, only a third of them are diagnosed and under control. Two-thirds of them are out of control, which is unbelievable considering what I just told you about what we know about disease and relatively expensive medication. So They kind of told us this story over and over again. Well, here's what it's like to be a patient in your system, you know, with hypertension. We have to, you know, take half a day off from work. We have to get to your clinic by car or by bus. We have to sit around in the waiting room reading five-year-old magazines. We spend 5 minutes with the doctor, who then changes our medication, and then we have to go sit down in the pharmacy and wait for that to get filled. And they said, you know, we'll do that once or twice, but after a while, for a condition that doesn't make us feel bad, and for the medications that sometimes have side effects, you know, you have not created the system. And in reality, you would think of the last time you went to your bank. You know, I haven't been in my bank in a decade because we do all our banking electronically, right? And so, you know, this is responding to really the patient's request for a much for a better system.
All right, I want to get a couple more questions in. Karen.
So I'm from Canada. So in the Canadian provinces, our hospital budgets have traditionally been global budgets. And there's now a move, particularly in British Columbia, to shift some of that to what is being called activity-based funding. So it's essentially DRG funding for a portion and ultimately an increasing portion of hospital care. So some of us who are policy people are being asked to discuss this and to comment on this. And so in Ontario, where there isn't such a threat of private for-profit clinics, there's a greater acceptance of the possibility that this might be a reasonable move, because global budgets have their problems too. In British Columbia, where we're at war with, in particular, Brian Day's private for-profit surgical center, which is operating illegally, we have great concern that it you know, breaks care into saleable units, as David and Steffi say in their paper, and allows then these private for-profit clinical surgical facilities to compete with the public hospitals. So if you were, there's a big debate going on, if you were in my policy shoes, what would you be asking, what would you be wondering about, what would your advice be?
I guess I'd be curious how broadly they were gonna, how broad a set of DRGs they were thinking of coming out with first. You know, if this was kind of a toe in the water, or if they were gonna come at it pretty whole hog. Because if it's a toe in the water, you have a lot of discretion to target those in intelligent ways. And again, you know, a surgical center, they must be very targeted in what they're interested in, and maybe there are ways to prioritize such that you can avoid those kinds of conflicts while getting at, you know, achieving what you wanted to achieve for the DRGs. Maybe there were some particularly high cost categories that the policymakers were interested in. I don't know, but that's kind of my first instinct is, you know, where do they want to go with it in the first step?
I might just correct one word. Are they competing or are they undermining the public facilities?
That's what I'm curious, of course, is that the private for-profits, we don't have private for-profit anything in terms of delivery. Everything is private, but not for-profit. So now when you throw in this for-profit, how can the same reimbursement rate work in a facility that has to profit when it's competing with a facility that is not for-profit? How's that?
Well, you have the advantage on us because here the rates are actually higher for the non-acute care settings. Yeah, they make more money off the same procedure than do general hospitals.
That's what we're worried about.
Well, but
they'll cherry pick the healthy patients and leave really sick patients.
It's not even that. They actually get paid a higher rate.
Oh,
here. So you're at least a leg up on that. I guess it's not a constructive answer to say count your blessings, but you know, these are the types of things to look out for.
Although that I can see is the slippery slope, where
right.
It starts at the same number and they say we have cost quality access, which do you want us to cut?
Right, or they'll call themselves an acute care hospital where they have, you know, a clerk as the emergency room.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I think Sarah, yeah, go ahead.
I'm wondering.
Maybe stand so easy to hear.
Sarah Kemble, I'm from Western Massachusetts. I'm working at a community health center there. And I'm wondering what CMS is thinking about that portion of the primary care infrastructure that is very small scale, rural, low tech, and financially completely on the edge right now, and what the plans are in the transition.
I'm going to be a little tentative in my answer because I'm at the moment much more assigned toward the accountable care organization half of the portfolio than the primary care medical homes half.
Well, maybe you could say how those practices fit into the...
Both. But I was going to say much of the thinking around medical homes is really targeted toward underserved populations. And so there will be fairly soon an announcement about medical homes, medical home programs for FQHCs, I think there's going to be a state program, state level, that is, Medicare will contract with states to come up with medical home programs. And so that's very much the weight of the focus right now at the agency. There will be another medical home initiative that is more broadly targeted, but it's just one among four or five, and most of those others are focused very much on safety net providers. On the ACO side, it's still in development, so please don't take this for anything written in stone, but there's certainly a number of us who are very committed to making certain that there are opportunities for thinking about organizations who aren't necessarily at the front of the line or who don't already have extensive experience taking on these types of contracts. And even, I think, open to the possibility of treating them differently, making it a carve-out opportunity.
Go ahead.
So could both of you comment about the role of patients and consumers in driving some of the quality? Again, I think when we use analogies from other industries about the level of information that we have and the kinds of questions we have, I don't think we have that expectation when we interact with our providers or our systems. So how do we as consumers and patients begin to ask the right questions and have the right information to ask the right questions?
I'm trying to work backwards to my mother, the Medicare patient, but I guess the cop-out answer is to say that we have every intent and have been engaging consumer organizations, such as Consumers Union and AARP, and we're trying to reach out of the beltway to do that. And I think that there are, again, everything, I'm working at a startup, so please don't take any of this to mean actual intent, but I can honestly say that part of the ongoing strategic conversation about what our innovation infrastructure will look like in the long term includes kind of a crowdsourcing aspect of it, so that there will be a very, very serious arm of environmental scanning and collecting, collating, proposed models or new priority areas that will be very democratic. That's the intent.
Small D, of course, right?
Small D.
I'm not sure I completely answered your question, but I do think that when you make it easier for patients to be involved in their care and understand what it is, the quality of care is, that they're happy to take on some of that responsibility. And we've done a series of quality improvement projects across a number of diseases and found that to be the case.
I think I'm going to ask the last question, unless, am I seeing one in the back row there? Come a little closer.
This is Julia Wong from the University of Tennessee, Health Science Center.
Maybe a little closer. I don't know if we can hear you.
Gather more information on those patients to understand that the interventions work for them as well.
surgeon make a decision about who should get the organ, they would say that, look at this guy, you know, he does not look educated and has tattoos on his arm, and probably he will not take good care of the organ. So let's not give the organ to this guy. And I heard from one hospital administrator that they are really evaluating on the success rate of the renal transplantation, for example, and they are evaluating on the long-term survival of the patients. So I was wondering whether you guys have comments about whether CMS is doing something to so that we will give the hospitals and the surgeons a different incentive so that these sources of disabilities are going to be eliminated.
It's an issue I care very much about. It's not anywhere close to my portfolio right now, so I don't want to give you misinformation. I unfortunately think that of the many, many initiatives ongoing addressing disparities, that not enough of them are coordinated with the payment policy conversations.
Thank you.
I guess if I could say one thing, it's certainly important for us to get away from deciding based on ability to pay. So to the extent to which these decisions become hard decisions that we make publicly under CMS, rather than let the market allocate them based on, you know, who is the most deserving based on ability to pay. So at least this forces the choices right there. I guess the other thing I would say is that this idea about more marketplace mentality about rewarding people about these outcomes, we're going to just have to think about ways of not having that be the central driver. I think those kinds of games and gamesmanship and signals are ones that we have to move in a different direction, and I think that's shared up here. Okay, so I think we're out of time. I think I'll take the privilege of one last hard question to Mai, since you came all this distance. We're really gonna get every inch of mileage. So you described your study in Vietnam that you did, and I actually don't know if you published it or were the results or what the findings are, but I wonder if you could sort of just generalize from whatever you did find. You alluded to some of the findings from the, private patients by day or by night, to what we're going to be doing with accountable care organizations. Are there any lessons that we can take from your first work to your future work? And maybe it's a hard question, but too vague. But what have you learned, and how can we benefit from that year you spent there?
Actually, that's okay. It's like I think there's a very direct relationship. So what we found was that, not surprisingly, although we were surprised by the magnitude of the difference, gynecologists when they saw their private patients who had similar reproductive tract infection symptoms, they used far more diagnostic testing, and much of it was inappropriate testing, and they prescribed far more medications, much of which was also inappropriate and completely out of line with the national guidelines. And neither were they in line with the WHO guidelines. And we presented this to them, to the subjects in the study. And you have to understand, it was ethically a little bit of a tricky experience because our observers were actually the medical students and residents who were training with some of these physicians. So we teamed them up, we paired them up so that they would have a little more fortitude. And they took the news rather well. They were, to the extent that they were able to laugh at themselves and kind of see the tragic comic nature of it. I didn't publish it. I wrote it up as an abstract, and I decided to let it die right there because I collaborated with these people, and I felt like it had had the impact locally that it was going to have. And I kind of didn't feel a need to embarrass them or my Vietnamese sponsors So that's kind of how that died. The relationship to the ACO work is that, you know, basically what we saw in Vietnam was a very primitive form of cost shifting. They couldn't make the living, they really could not make a living on their public sector salaries. And you know, there were many, many sources of my compassion for them, but it is very difficult to live in a society where travel agents make tenfold what teachers who are revered in Vietnam and physicians make. That's a hard thing. It was like being there at the end of the Vietnam War when outside money just turns the world upside down. So in that reality, they did what they had to do for their families through their private clinics. And it's not that they didn't see what they were doing to their private patients, but they really felt that they were giving those patients what those patients wanted. And there is not the infrastructure, there's not the civil society infrastructure there to support patients and advocate for consumers the way that there is here. So there are very few medical societies, and they are not convened around patients' needs at all, and certainly there are not that many consumer advocacy organizations. So it was a very tough situation. But this cost-shifting aspect is the relationship I see to the ACO work, because one of the as-yet-to-be-solved problems is what happens in the market, in real marketplaces, when you have an organization that might take on an ACO contract with Medicare and perform very well in terms of saving Medicare dollars, and then turns around and with this imprimatur of being a Medicare ACO and the prestige that brings, never mind the market position that they already enjoyed, you know, in their community, they will strong arm private payers into paying much higher rates, and you have done nothing to solve the healthcare spending problem. You've just hidden it. And that problem is being worked on, and I think that there are ways to mitigate it. Again, not reflecting policies or programs, but my own personal thinking here that, for example, we can be very careful in how we select the organizations we decide to work with in this first phase, based on their market position and perhaps letters of good standing from their local payers. And we can also collect independent data on where they are in the marketplace and what happens to those private sector prices during the course of the experiment. I mean, it is an experiment. We're very much aspiring for it to be a pragmatic trial. So we want to know how this works in the real world. We're not going to find a sterile marketplace. Right. You go to an accomplished health system, and for sure they're going to have substantial market position wherever they already exist.
All right. Well, thank you everybody for coming. And,